I'm going to give you a talk this evening about the increase of efficiency. Before I do that, I had better define myself very clearly. We are not talking in this particular instance about efficiency as described by the psychologist. And I wish to be very, very definite about that. I would like to be very definite about Dianetics and Scientology. At no time should you infer, even vaguely, that we are talking about psychology. And we are not even talking in the framework of psychology. Psychology is an interesting subject which originally intended to apply scientific methodology to the field of the mind. That was by Professor Wundt, a German, almost 100 years ago. Unfortunately, as the years went on, scientific methodology became better and better understood, and this better understanding of scientific methodology did not continue to be applied to the mind until today. A psychologist is not trained in any scientific methodology of any character that would be recognized as such by a physicist, a chemist, or a mathematician. And the field, 19th century psychology, has stayed with us, a brave effort, a very discouraging effort, actually, for the excellent reason that the psychologist has attempted continuously to retain this original idea, which was advanced by Professor Wundt, and has not understood it. He has not progressed. A psychologist today does not treat the mind. He does not increase efficiency. He does not cure illnesses. And according to Dr. Mann, the last authority on the subject of psychology here in the United States, he's one of the best authorities, the starting words of his last book on the subject of psychology says very adequately that psychology cannot be understood as a word unless one examines its history, and then that the word psychology is taken from the Greek spirit, but that psychology has very little to do with the spirit or even with the mind. And that is the definition of the word psychology. Now, I want to make that very clear for this reason. I'm going to talk to you tonight about increasing efficiency, not measuring the increase of efficiency. You remember the Confederacy had a high tide at Gettysburg. You know, Pickett's charge was the high tide of the Confederacy. So did psychology, in its approach on this problem, have a high tide. And that high tide was measure something. They got the idea that they could measure something. And today, the field of psychology itself, as such, does not say to do anything about efficiency or increase anybody's efficiency or even define what somebody's efficiency is, but in the words from another modern text, says that nobody could even estimate a normal. It'd be impossible even to get an average in the field of human ability. And psychology doesn't do this. But psychology does measure, they say, aptitude and efficiency, and that's not what we're talking about. We are not talking about measuring what your IQ is, since we'd first have to define to our satisfaction what we meant by IQ. We can't do that, because IQ actually would possibly be this is just a possible definition, the ability of an individual to pose and resolve problems. But that is not the definition. IQ possibly might be that thing, but it is not that thing. So we're not interested in measuring your efficiency from the standpoint of what your IQ is, or measuring your IQ to establish what your efficiency is. This is not what we're talking about. And I'm just trying to get out of the road here before we talk about efficiency in any way, shape, or form. The idea of measuring it and trying to tell somebody how many kilowatts a man runs on, or how many microamps. See, we're not interested in that. We're not interested in regarding man as a machine, the fatal step taken by psychology. Man is not a machine. Man is much better than a machine. So, what we're talking about very abruptly, very bluntly, is this. The efficiency of an individual can be varied, and efficiency of an individual can be increased, it can be bettered, or it can be worsened. Now, that is the first thing that we would care to say about efficiency. And let me call to your attention that this has never been stated in the field of psychology and is not believed by psychology. So right here, right at the beginning, if you have yourself had some training in this field of psychology, if you were forced, as most students are when they go to a university, take a year of psychology. I don't know why they do that. Neither does the student when he's finished. But if you're forced to take a year of psychology, you might have some preconception of what we mean by efficiency. And we mean, first and foremost, this. Man's efficiency is a variable factor. And it can be increased or worsened. It is not a stable, steady factor, nor does it remain stable or steady long enough to be adequately measured. Of course, it is often measured in the opinion of some boss. Boss, you know, been out of party the night before, papers on his desk are all cluttered up. Jones supposed to keep all that straight. Jones been tending to a couple emergencies the boss should have attended to while the boss was absent, see? So he didn't have a chance to straighten up the papers. So he says, "Mr. Jones, firing, he's not efficient." That's just an opinion, isn't it? Just an opinion. As many a man has been discharged from a job as being inefficient on that job, only to have the boss discover, after he's had five more replacements in sequence, that he would have been better off if he'd left the first guy there. We're not interested in measuring anybody's efficiency. The subject here on efficiency is just this, and this is a brand new fact. It would be a startling new fact in the field of psychology, therefore we must remove ourselves immediately from that field, and that is this. Man's efficiency is very variable. It is too variable, actually, to be susceptible to measurement of a graph or test type, and it can be bettered and it can be worsened by two things. One, by the various conditions of life which the individual confronts. That betters or worsens his efficiency. A railroad locomotive engineer gets up in the morning, has a fight with his wife, goes down, and he misses a couple of signals. He's not efficient at all. His efficiency has been worsened by his environment. A steamboat captain is trying to get his ship into a small berthing, and it's very foggy, and the currents are running very treacherously, and he keeps banging the dock and buckling up plates and so forth. That's not very efficient, is it? But it's his level of efficiency, whereby he normally just went into the berth, is worsened by the conditions in the environment. Therefore, this berthing was not as efficient. Unless we take some other factors into consideration, we don't get any kind of an idea of his efficiency at all. All right. Now, there's a couple of conditions of worsening. Now, his efficiency could be better. This girl has been working on the job for a very long time. She's been working for this boss, and he has never looked at her twice. And one morning, why, he looks at her, and he says, "You know, I'm very glad you're working here." You know, and he passes on, sits down on his desk. Her efficiency goes way up. She takes the papers out from in back of the file drawer, where she hasn't been filing them, and starts actually to put them in. Now, her efficiency's been bettered, hasn't it? So there is a variable right there. All right, now let's move into the next stage. Efficiency can actually be bettered by processing, as in Dianetics and Scientology. You actually can alter a person's efficiency. And if somebody, not a professional auditor, somebody was not informed, went tampering with somebody's mind, fooling around with it, you know, monkeying around like a priest or something, you know, saying the devils are going to get you or something of the sort if you don't be a good boy. If somebody tampers with his mind with malice aforethought, as in the Russian army, intends that the individual shall be subjected to certain duresses and so on, we would find that the individual's efficiency could be worsened also by processes, you might say. In other words, bad processes, bad handling, and so forth of the mind could worsen somebody's efficiency. Now, let us take the record, for instance, of an old-time therapy called psychoanalysis. We take the record of the psychoanalysis. We discover that rather uniformly, the individual's efficiency, whereas his longevity might have been increased by being more careful of life, you know, and so forth, that his efficiency normally suffers. I knew an advertising executive once. He used to get out copy and bright ideas, and there were papers flying all over the office every time you went in, and everybody looked haggard because they were trying to keep up with this man's speed. And he was a powerhouse. And he got married. And he married this girl, and she was a former model. And she was a former model. That's the polite word for it in New York. And this little character started worrying him by going out with the elevator operator and the janitor and the chauffeur and, you know, other things that they sometimes do in New York. And this fellow started to get kind of hollow-eyed, you know. He'd come home, he didn't know who'd been using his pajamas. That was what was worrying him. And laundry bill kept going up. Anyway, he wasn't throwing papers around in the office. He was just sort of sitting there looking haggard. It hadn't occurred to him yet to shoot her or throw her in the East River. And unfortunately, this morning, somebody came in, namely one of the directors of the firm, and suggested to him that he go over on Park Avenue and see a psychoanalyst. And that was the thing. This would straighten out everything. Well, this guy's resistance was very low. The next time I met this man, he was clerking for the same firm. But he was awfully sane. That time I was experimenting in Dianetics a long time ago. I was experimenting away, and he'd heard something about what I was doing. He says very carefully, don't start in on me. You know, I'm all right. This is typical psychoanalysis, ex-psychoanalytic patient reaction. If I watch it, you see, and I stay right there, and I go along just so, and I keep a careful regimen, why, I'll be all right. Another fellow I knew had 3 years in psychoanalysis and wound up as the janitor of the apartment house he had owned before. I mean, I'm not slamming psychoanalysis. I'm merely giving you some data. It happens to be data. I refer you, by the way, to a far more sweeping article on this subject, which appeared in an American magazine many years ago. This is tampering around with the mind. Fooling around with it, trying to attribute everything to sex is really fooling around with somebody's mind, because it just doesn't attribute, that's all. And it was a good effort, and there was a lot of good work went in on it, and it got popular, as sex normally is. And it sort of fizzled out. Actually, there's very few analysts in practice in the country today. The truth of the matter is that efficiency could be worsened by somebody addressing immediately and directly the problems of the mind. Now, let's make that very clear. It could be worsened. We have somebody who is capable of putting in 8 hours a day of work, and he's doing all right with his 8 hours a day, and he's going home and going to movies sometime. He's getting along all right. He's not too unhappy about life, and he is unlucky enough to get into the hands of some quack psychologist, as the psychologists normally call themselves. That, by the way, is the truth. The American Psychological Association does nothing but fight quack psychologists. It's practically nothing. They've carried on a whole campaign out in Long Beach, and the papers were continuously filled with this phrase, quack psychologists. And tonight I was rather interested to pick up the paper and find out a couple of boys who have a vested interest in psychology were talking about it in the legislature just today, about quack psychologists, and if they'd mentioned the name of our organization in any way, shape, or form, would have sued them. But why would I have sued them for calling a psychologist? Now, everybody knows what a psychologist is by the advertising of the American Psychological Association. He's a quack. They have hit this line so hard, they pretend at the same time, they leave unstated this fact, and evidently thereby leaving it unstated, you see, that they do something for the mind, that they actually are in charge of therapy, or that they do some therapy, or there's some therapy involved here somewhere. The truth of the matter is that psychology and Dianetics and Scientology have entirely different philosophies. And they're entirely different. One, the message of the psychologist is, in every one of his textbooks, man is well adjusted when he has adjusted himself thoroughly to his environment. And if you look that over carefully, you will find that the only thing that denotes any progress for man is the times when he adjusts his environment to him. You see that? He has to adjust the environment to him. He doesn't adjust himself to the environment. That is the activity of a turtle or an armadillo. He's gone and adjusted himself to the environment, you know. He's grown a big, thick shell. Man doesn't grow a thick shell. He breaks out some engineering plans and builds himself a steam-heated house. He fixes himself up so he can use the various elements with which the environment abounds in order to may live a happier and more active life. And that is why man progresses, according to Dianetics Scientologists, because he adjusts the environment to him. This is a slave philosophy. The only thing that ever makes me angry on the subject is to see anywhere in the country a slave philosophy being directed immediately at our youth. Because these will not function well. If you make enough of a slave out of the young man and the young woman, you've got your juvenile delinquent. You've got your criminal. So, the philosophies are different. Well, let's get on to something a little happier here. Let's get on to this field of efficiency. Now, an engineer's idea of efficiency is an interesting idea. Engineer's idea of efficiency is very, very perfect. It's simply this. Input over output. That's efficiency. All there is to it. Therefore, we should eat a big dinner and then do as much work, activity, or play, as many calories worth, as we've eaten a dinner. Well, this is an engineer's efficiency. Now, here we have a steam engine. Steam engine's about 9% efficient in cold weather, chilly weather, about 9% efficient. You put in some tremendous amount of coal and get out some small amount of mechanical motion in the wheels. That's efficiency. Electrical current is an interesting thing from the standpoint of efficiency. You pour so much current in this end, and then there's so much resistance turning into heat or turning otherwise into mechanical motion and so on. You get something out at the other end, and you have an efficiency. It's a percentage of input over output. So thee and me talk rather consistently about our efficiency or the efficiency of health or the efficiency of an individual in life. Well, if we're talking about this word efficiency and using it as it is designed to be used, which is simply in the engineering field, because it is a word from engineering, we are talking about the amount of work this person does for the amount of food and sunlight he consumes. See? He consumes so many calories of our heat units of sunlight or calories of food. See? And then we find out how much of this he exerts. You know, how much is expended in mechanical motion. So that we would feed this fellow big spoon or something of the sort, and we'd feed this fellow a certain amount of food, and then we'd make him walk on a treadmill, you know, and he'd walk on this treadmill and turn it so many times before he felt very hungry or exhausted, something, you see. And then we would feed him some more food from a spoon, and then he'd go back on this treadmill again, and we'd finally find out how many potential heat units there were in cream of wheat, and how many our boy had exerted in turning the treadmill. Now, you see that? Don't look so worried. I'm not going to mad dog anymore about psychology. I'm going to talk to you about something real, real factual here, real, real factual. And you will see why I talk to you about psychology. We just haven't any truck at all with this measurement of efficiency for man. I'll tell you why right now. Well, this would be the scientific method of looking at the efficiency of a man, is how much cream of wheat do we spoon down him to get out how many this and that. Now, some scientist, quote unquote, most abused word in our modern times is this word scientist. They had a better definition when Boris Karloff played the part. The efficiency of an individual cannot be measured then exactly in this framework. We shovel so many British thermal units or ergs into our army and they walk so many miles. Well, why can't we measure it this way? Why can't we measure it this way? If we were treating a machine, if we were treating something which was entirely mechanical, which clanked, this would be true, but it is not true for the individual man. Why not? Because his environment can better and worsen his efficiency. By doing what? Putting up more ergs of resistance to him? Putting up more walls for him to climb? Oh no, that would come under an engineering definition, wouldn't it? For instance, we say, oh well, this fellow's efficiency is worsened by the reason of the fact that he has to lift these paper boxes 5 feet to stack them instead of 4 feet. So therefore we've lessened his... No, no, you see, actually, we would merely compute that. We would say this fellow had so many calories, Wheaties, the breakfast of champions. He had so many calories, and then he lifted so many pounds of paper up on a shelf 5 feet tall, and therefore we divide these two together, and we get an efficiency rating for him, and we say this man is a 37.5 percenter. Nah, see, this doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because there's a second method of bettering and worsening his efficiency. He gets up in the morning, he eats a large breakfast of Wheaties or dog biscuit or whatever they eat these days, and he eats this large breakfast, and he goes down and he says to his wife, "Goodbye, dear," and she doesn't answer. And he says, "Hey, I said goodbye." She doesn't say a word. She just sits there. He says, "All right." He starts out. What's she mad about? What's she mad about? Well, he goes down to work. He's eaten so many ergs of Wheaties. See? And he starts picking up these boxes and putting them on a 5-foot shelf. And he says, "Well, what the devil was she so mad about?" "Oh, well, go on. After a while, he feels kind of tired and gets to go out for a smoke, talk to the boys a little bit, and so on. Foreman comes down and sees he's only stacked 2 boxes all morning. Well, some of these scientists, so-called, have it all mocked up, gorgeous effort, to say that mental effort consumes a great deal of energy. And this is how they try to correct this incorrect figure, see? And they say, well, it consumes this much. Do you know what I've done? It's actually been done. Put various types of detectors in the vicinity of somebody's head to detect the amount of heat being generated by worry. The amount of energy being consumed, as we understand energy in engineering, by thought. And I've had some of the fanciest encephalographs, EEGs they call them, hooked up to people, make them worry and think to find out what energy is being consumed. And good heavens, it's about... some incredible tiny amount. It isn't converting into some other ray. We tried to detect that, and there was no other ray there to be detected. It isn't being consumed. Well, he's not expending it. Where's it going? Must be going someplace. Well, let's all get real smart and let's figure out what the thyroid has to do with the hyperdynes and exactly how that crisscrosses the wobble guts. Only these are all non-existent things. So we say to the individual, well, evidently after he ate this input over output, we'd have to go through some various slightly more embarrassing tests to discover how much of his food he was wasting. And if we went through these tests and tested out his efficiency in that direction, we would still not be able to answer this question of what the devil happened to the Wheaty Wheaties. And as long as we keep on trying to figure man out on the basis of what happened to the Wheaty Wheaties, we're studying Wheaty Wheaties and not man. And that's all there is to it. You should see that very clearly. The fuel consumption of an individual under the bulk of conditions is inverse to the amount of energy he puts out within certain limits. The fellow who eats 55,000 ergs of Wheaty Wheaties for breakfast is probably not going to put out as much real work as the fellow who only ate 15,000. Well, this just washes the whole problem up as this problem in machines. In other words, the less gasoline you pour into the car, the faster it runs. Did you ever see somebody who weighed himself about 895 pounds just working like mad? Did you ever watch how much food this individual consumed? I once knew a long, stringy, lean cowboy. And he used to sit down and he had a... The Chinese cook would put on a big bucket of flapjacks on the table. And this boy would spoon out about 12 flapjacks, you know, and he'd cut down and put them down. You could see him go down his gullet and his Adam's apple would jump. And there'd go 12 flapjacks. And then there would go 12 more flapjacks. And then there would go 12 more flapjacks. And about this time, the Chinese cook would start to look mad. This fella would go out and sit on a fence rail for the rest of the day. It was tremendous input, but we could say, well, he wasn't efficiently utilizing the fuel. Had anything to do with it. Guy was in perfect health, nothing wrong with him. Any kind of test you want to make on him showed that 36 flapjacks had been consumed. Then we have this small woman. She weighs about 95 pounds, and she drinks a cup of coffee, and then she gets down to work, and she cleans up the house, and cleans up the kids, and cleans up this and that, and goes out and raises half a dozen chickens all in a rush, and cooks dinner for the thrashers, and so forth, and we look in vain to find some input. Where the devil is the input? Where? Obviously. She's working on next to no food, and she's a very active person. Efficiency. Well, it just doesn't figure out on this engineering classification. It doesn't figure out at all, the engineering classification. Let's figure it out on an emotional classification, though. The individual is all right if his emotions are all right, but if you stir up the wrong emotion, his efficiency drops. The fellow who is working, trying to work, or trying not to work all morning, worried about why his wife was mad. She was mad, by the way, because he took the car, and he didn't think of that till 2 o'clock. It was her day to have the car. He remembered this suddenly. But all that morning, you could say that the counter-emotion, the emotional involvement because of a domestic situation itself was sufficient to pull out of action the number of calories which ordinarily should have been expended in work. Nah. Doesn't work. Because a man who's mad, if you look him over very carefully, isn't moving. A man who's really mad is making motions which counter motions and isn't moving. Now, as he goes from just being angry into rage, he will alternately throw away from himself and drag back to himself and expend some energy. But just a fellow who is demonstrating anger is more or less stopped. Now, that isn't consuming a lot of energy. It isn't either. Only he'll feel drained and exhausted afterwards. Emotion. It isn't any explanation for it at all. It doesn't explain it on the endocrine system, and it again doesn't explain man as a machine, an emotional machine. You can study the endocrine system endlessly to find any kind of a real solution to this situation. I can speak with that as a considerable an authority. I studied the endocrine system very, very hard at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital for a year in an effort to discover whether or not what I'm just going to tell you about, the mind, whatever that is, monitored structure, or whether structure monitored the mind. It obviously did it to some degree through the endocrine system. But the endocrine system did not monitor the structure, because you could take somebody who was deficient in thyroid and feed him full of thyroid and he still sat there. Thyroid's supposed to make him really get to work. Well, if thyroid and the endocrine system was the answer, all you'd have to do is take this cowboy who consumes all these hotcakes and beef him up with thyroid, you know, and he'd go out and pitch hay like mad. So we beef him up with thyroid, and we say, well, he's going to go out there and really pitch hay now. And he goes out and sits down on the fence just like before. No change. So the endocrine system is no answer with regard to this, no matter how much somebody might tell you you should take pills. After all, Lilly, Park, Davis, people like that, got to eat. They got to pay dividends. And sometimes the pills do work. What do you know? Sometimes they don't. But, everything is all hit or miss anyhow. We don't care. We'll just feed everybody who looks a certain way a certain kind of pill. And the 30% recovery that we get, we will attribute it to the pills. It's sufficient. So the endocrine system isn't it. Because it doesn't burn up any heat to amount to anything compared to the amount of heat being put in. Remember, it's still a problem in Wheaty Wheaties and how much heat and mechanical energy was taken out of the man. So the endocrine system, the glands and so forth, the body at large, it solves nothing. So let's look this over and let's discover here, however, that we are into this kind of a setup here. We have three things which are of interest to you. Thought, emotion, and effort. Now, they're written in this form because effort, only to a slight degree, has a bearing on emotion and thought. But thought, on discovery, has a great deal of bearing on emotion and effort. And if we look this problem over thoroughly, we'll find out that the fellow who couldn't get more active, we fed him thyroid pills, and he didn't get more active, this cowboy. Yet, by processing in Dianetics and Scientology, would change his mind about whether or not he ought to work. And having changed his mind, he might go on consuming 36 hotcakes, but he would do some work. Same input, same emotional stresses and strains, but he's changed his mind about work. He merely thought before this time, anybody who works is a sucker. Maybe that's what he thought about life. Such a person, by the way, one time as I was handling this person processing, and he had this postulate, he had this thought, very uppermost in his mind. Other people get by without working, so why can't I? Very sick person, by the way, sick all the time. He had said, I don't want to handle this stuff called effort. This same person, by the way, had also said, oh, I don't know, emotion's a bad thing. I just don't want much to do with emotional people, particularly enthusiastic people. Oh, that's bad. That's bad. Well, this individual had checked out these two points. He just checked them right out. He checked out emotion. He checked out effort. He said emotion and effort, these were all bad. And I don't want anything to do with them. Under processing, I got him to change his mind about emotion and change his mind about effort. Not even to change his mind about work, particularly. But this postulate suddenly showed up. Everybody else gets by without working, so why shouldn't I? And it showed up, and he looked at it, and it started to look awfully silly to him. You know, he got very amused with it, and suddenly remembered that his mother used to talk about that all the time, and so forth, and he remembered that he had the idea that he could get by in life without working, and he sort of changed his mind about this whole thing, and things brightened up, and he himself could have a better emotional reaction, and he himself started to be perfectly not only just willing to handle effort, but he became rather impatient at the idea of not having some exercise, you know. He had to get out there and get some exercise, and push things around. So we changed this part of these three parts here, and we found out that this part was the important part to change, right there, thought. Now, naturally, this is a limited statement, because if somebody has a broken leg, he is not going to be efficient in walking. And if this person has just lost her father or something of the sort, why, we're going to have emotion being rather trying. But here you have the instantaneous situation. We have an instantaneous situation as opposed to a long, drawn-out situation. The overall picture of life doesn't present us with 100% broken legs. It presents us with only, well, thinking of some classes and professions, only 99% broken legs. When we have thought up here in a pretty straight state of affairs, so the individual's in control of what he thinks and can change his mind at will, he can handle this stuff called effort, he can handle this stuff called emotion. But just because this fellow's got large biceps is no reason he can handle this or work. That's an oddity, isn't it? Just because he's got tremendous biceps. I knew a weightlifter one time. He was also a nuclear physicist. He dreamed up, by the way, I tell you this man's story is very interesting. He dreamed up a method of building a cyclotron for $10,000. They normally cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 or $1 million or $2 million, something like that. And he dreamed up a method of doing this, of building a cyclotron, and GE and the rest of the companies heard about it. So they got him for subversive influence. And they put it down as subversive influence. He'd been talking in a bar, and somebody had overheard him, and they couldn't quote what he said, but they swore it was subversive, so they fired him. So this individual became an instructor in mechanical engineering at a small university, some jerkwater university, University of California. He became this, and he sat over there, and he often wondered what had happened to him, why he was so subversive. He started worrying about it. They told him he was, and the idea got sort of fixed in his head that he was. This fellow was a weightlifter, as an avocation. And he could lift the most tremendous weights you ever heard of. But now, he was not working for the government. He had to work for a living. He had to go down and teach classes and hike around the campus and attend tea parties and balance cups of tea while talking to the rest of the faculty. Effort, you know. And it almost killed him. I saw him talk to him about it, and he said, this is the most exhausting stuff you ever heard of. I mean, it's just exhausting. I don't know how I... But he was a weightlifter. They told him he was subversive, so he thought it over carefully, and he eventually joined the Civil Rights Congress and the I Will Arise Society, other subversive groups. And this fellow, big muscles, but he himself wasn't there very well. Somebody tell him something. Well, here was the most tremendously developed biceps you ever wanted to see in your life. And he was weak in his head. Real weak. So I gave this boy some processing. It was a rather interesting thing. Gave him some processing, sneaked up on him when he wasn't looking. And I began to wonder while processing who in his past had been very averse to effort. And we found out that the only kind of effort anybody who was a gentleman could engage upon, you know, was a sport. A gentleman could engage in sport. But only a dog, a bum, a tramp, a hobo, something like that, would ever get in there and use these muscles in a thing called work. And as far as emotion was concerned, everybody who was emotional was automatically a woman. Emotion equals feminine equals woman. Equals emotion, equals no good. That's out. So we found out that although he did have a limited development in the field of effort and no development in the field of emotion, that he'd been exercised. You have any idea how an athlete has to be exercised? You know, he has to get out there and run around the track and so on. And this man had kept it up the time he was about 35 when I processed him. And he was out there exercising all the time. In other words, all this exercise had no altering factor in his ability to use effort. But when I processed him, got him to change his mind about the horribleness of effort and the horribleness of emotion. Got him to change his mind about these two factors, and he started working. Really started working. First time he'd ever done it in his life, he was quite surprised. It was fun. It was fun. And people could come in and just get as mad at him as they wanted to, and he stopped cringing. He'd actually sit there, look at him, and maybe get mad back. He had no aversion to this. But he was alive. Why? We changed his mind. His mind. Not his emotion with a bunch of thyroid pills. We didn't do that. He'd certainly had all the exercising anybody had ever needed to develop muscles. So we didn't do anything with that. We changed his mind. Well, this is a very interesting thing. What is this thing called a mind, then? Well, the actual truth of the matter is, the mind is a machine which looks like this. That's a mind. It's a thing. It has neurons. It has switchboards. Or are we talking about a mind? We're talking about a brain. Ran a process here just a week or so ago. I asked you to think a thought with your brain. I saw a lot of people try and try, but they couldn't make that brain think of a thing. It didn't. It just sat there. That's a mind, a machine. Only it's not a mind at all. There's something present, evidently, that has nothing whatsoever to do with emotion or effort. There's something that is not composed of emotion or effort. Something in the human anatomy that isn't composed of emotion or effort. But which can create or alter or vanquish emotion and effort. So, we look at this picture here, and we find out that here we have a creative substance or a somethingness, and then we have a sort of a light mass or flow that you would call emotion, and then we have a heavy mass here that you would call effort. And we have these three things, and this question mark, whatever it is, can monitor these things. Efficiency. All the efficiency an individual has depends entirely upon his ability to make up his own mind or change it concerning emotion and effort. He can't change his mind. He cannot change his emotion and effort. He can go down to the doctor and get himself pumped full of endocrine fluids. He can go down to the gymnasium and he can exercise and exercise and exercise. Every once in a while, some kid in the organization, some young fella, sometimes some of the older guys in the organization, and I have a little fun Indian wrestling. And it is an interesting activity. But I don't exercise. Of course, they don't either, do amount to anything. But I shouldn't have any bicep. I shouldn't have any grip. I don't exercise every day. Of course, I really know it when I've been out on some kind of a sport run or something on a Sunday. I'm quite well aware of the fact that I have been exercising till I change my mind about it. But I was very, very interested in the war. Many times I had an athlete aboard. And this boy, I had one who was a killer. he was a killer. He got around the officer's country, the outer deck around officer's country with a skip rope, you know, and he'd run with weights in his hands, and boy, was he in shape all the time, you know. He was in shape. I mean, he was right there. I mean, he was in good condition. But when 9 o'clock came, he went unconscious. He didn't go to sleep. He just went unconscious. He used himself as, he thought of himself as a machine. And therefore, it was a machine he had to keep in good condition. And before he did anything, he had to prepare himself for it. He had to go through special exercises or something like that. We gave him a special exercise. We used to prop him up against the bulkhead for his 12 to 4 a.m. watch with a petty officer there shaking him. He stood his watches, but he never did get over it. Well, so something in this here should be of interest to the individual. If you don't exercise yourself into greater efficiency and you don't emotionalize yourself into greater efficiency, why, how can you possibly be more efficient? Well, let's qualify the word efficiency from the standpoint of Dianetics and Scientology. Efficiency would be the fewness of motions which you could exert to get a job done, and the mostness of job done in the leastness of time so as to be able to do other jobs. The fewness of motions to get the mostest job done. And the efficiency, that makes for great accuracy, doesn't it? Of course, it requires quite an opponent to stay in there playing a game with you if you're doing that sort of thing. Think of yourself as a fencing master, and the fellow comes out to fence with you, and you get all cinched, you know, and bang, you tag him. He says, that isn't fair. So you say, okay, now the theory we're up against here, the theoretical thing, is you're trying to touch me, and I'm trying to touch you, and I'm trying to keep you from touching me, and you're trying to keep... Now, you all set? That's the end of that again. Well, it'd mean the other fellow would have to be in as good a condition, too, but it'd make an awfully fast game, wouldn't it? Make an awfully fast game. People who want a game to last try to slow it down and get inefficient about playing it. That's the truth of the matter. They get inefficient about playing. Did you ever watch in a circus, watch the strong man get that bar or pole or with 18 girls on it or something of the sort, and watch those muscles bulge as he staggers around, you know, oh boy, that's hard, and he sets it down like this, so forth. And I watched a fellow one time who would put on a beautiful show, boy, bulging biceps and every other thing, and he lifted this bar, and he got it up there, and he got it down again. Man, it was hard. He was dusting his hands off and throwing a handkerchief around, you know. It was real tough. And then one of the props men came out and picked up the bar. Little squirt. Trouble is, it was a heavy bar. Only the little guy didn't think it was. The audience was impressed, but the strong man wasn't. All right. When we have a game going, why, we very often like to show how difficult it is to play this game. Sometimes we see a golf player who is semi-pro or, you know, a medium rank sort of golf player. Boy, he gets out there, and the number of times that he shifts his knees and wiggles his club and straightens out his shirt and so forth and gets ready to go. Really fantastic. People down here at the Open watching some real pros who play very efficient golf were very struck by an idea, but not by any wild balls. The pros come in, they throw their clubs down, and they take the right club, and they pow, see, and that was gone 225 yards down the fairway, and they pick up their clubs and go after it. Watch those same men a few years from now. They're trying to impress the gallery a little bit more, and they'll start to adjust too. The best player down there made the least motions. He was the most accurate. That's what we mean by efficiency. Get the mostest done with the leastest motions. It doesn't necessarily follow that an individual should be efficient about his play, but you get an awful lot of playing done. But it does follow that an individual, if he's on a sort of a routine job where he's trying to get something done that is some kind of sort of a task, it should follow that an individual should get enough done in the allocated length of time to clean the decks and permit himself free time. Let's say he's working on a job which does not necessarily engross all of his interests, and he has other things which he would rather do, but he has to work on the job economically. Well, the thing to do with that job economically is do the mostest job you can in the leastest possible time and park it and then play. If you look at most people, their efficiency is most efficient and most apparent in getting a reasonable amount of apparent motion into 8 hours. If you go into a large office, you will see that this is largely the case. There are people who are trying to look reasonably in motion for 8 hours. One of the most horrible things you could do to a society would be to say, you see that time clock? That's your boss. Now, you've got to be in the office from the time clock goes pong in the morning to the time clock goes pong in the evening. Do you think anybody really balls them out to amount to anything for doing anything or not doing anything on the job? No, not if they're working for Boeing or something like that. Nobody does. Nobody does. But let that card in the time clock show that they left 30 seconds early or came 30 seconds late, and they're up talking to at least the 15th vice president. See? That clock is God. Well, it's an evil God at best. Because it says you don't have a job, you got a jail. That's what it says. It would be a very dull corporation which continually harped upon the time clock and hammered about how many hours one put in on the job. It actually isn't important how many hours one puts in on a job. It's how much one accomplishes. You don't even have to say per unit time. It's just how much one accomplishes. You know, there are an awful lot of people who work and work and work, and they obviously must be accomplishing something, because you see them go this way with a bunch of papers and that way with a bunch of papers, and you see papers. And at the end of the day, if you were to go over and look at their desk, you'd find out the letters they were supposed to answer that morning are still sitting there unanswered that evening, and that nothing has happened in the interim. But they sure were busy. This is the sort of a fellow who is normally promoted, by the way. That's why so many vice presidents are people like this. They make enough furor and fuss, or they call enough attention, but they are not getting anything done. An efficient way to look at efficiency is to figure out first what the corporation is trying to do, or the company, or the family, or the individual, and then wrap it up. See, that's the efficient way to look at it. Not enter a bunch of time clocks and this and that along the line. The way to do it is just figure out, what are we trying to do? All right, let's do it. You know? And that would be efficient. But what does that require? What's the first thing that requires? It requires something very few corporations ever have. Very, very few corporations ever have. Thought. The amount of executive planning, which normally should be underway in a big company, a corporation, a government, something of that sort, the amount of executive planning which is done is almost zero. What the executive does, he sits there caught in a crisscross of communication lines where he is incapable of making a forward plan. He is too involved with trying to catch up with the plans which were laid in 1910. And one day he wakes up and he's broke. The corporation's broke. Why is it broke? Like a cartoon I saw once, he said, we couldn't possibly be broke. We would make the best buggy whips in the world. No, it'd first require thought. Matt'd have to say, what are we doing? Where are we going? What are we trying to do with all this action, motion, mass? What are we trying to do with all these emotional appeals and heavy objects? If you don't know, you've got chaos. You know what chaos is? That's chaos. Emotion and effort. And the only way you ever bring anything like order into chaos is to make thought more important in the regulation of it than effort. You know, it's a very stupid general who permits parleys to take place. It's very stupid because a general's mission is war. And when people start thinking about it, there's peace. It's a very dumb general that lets people talk. Silence in the ranks. The war must go on. That's why they keep arresting people for talking during wartime. Then sooner or later they forget to arrest some fellows, and the idea gets around that we ought to have peace, and we have peace. Here we'd have an individual who was very, very inefficient then. He's a very inefficient individual, one who runs on emotional and responses and effort responses. This, unfortunately, if we block these two out, would leave us with a god. Thought alone, no emotion, no effort, total serenity. Well, we're human beings, and we like this game called humanity, and so we try to achieve some balance amongst thought, emotion, and effort, because if we don't have some emotion and effort in it, we haven't got any game, it's no fun, we've got no friends, no communication. So we can't go all out for this thing called thought and be 100% thought. It's got to be something else in it. But the moment when somebody comes along and tries to tell you that the human being is a machine, and if that machine is efficient or inefficient, we get the idea that we must be running on emotions and efforts. And a human being won't equate out as a machine on that at all. An individual, simply by changing his mind, can treble his efficiency. The best way to change your mind about your efficiency is to find out whether or not you're doing what you want to do or going in a direction that you want to go. And if you just sit down for a moment and say, well, what do I want to do? You're liable to get into a terrible thing called a comm lag. What am I doing? But that would be the first step in increasing anyone's efficiency, is finding out what one was trying to do. And then you could get awfully efficient about it. But let's take a look at a fencer who has gone into a fencing match that he doesn't know is a fencing match. He might have known fencing once, but he doesn't know the rules now, and he doesn't know what he's supposed to do with the button of his foil, when that I'm supposed to
get some dirt out of the cracks in the ceiling or pick his teeth with it. And we tell him, all right, now let's do an efficient job of fencing. He doesn't know what this is, so he starts to build a corral inside the gymnasium. He isn't going to be very far along the line. He isn't going to be an efficient fencer. Well, what do we think of a clerk who doesn't know what he's supposed to be as a clerk? What about a man that doesn't know what a man is supposed to do, or a woman who doesn't know what a woman's supposed to do, or hasn't figured it out? He wouldn't be very efficient, neither would she, would she? Well, the first lesson that we could learn in efficiency doesn't have very much to do with processing. It just had to do with, hey, what am I doing anyhow? You know? And then figure it out so you get good and certain about what you're doing. And then having gotten good and certain about it, do it with the most economy of effort and emotion. And by golly, you'll be a shooting star. You know, there's probably nobody in the 150 million people that are alive in the United States today. Nobody, maybe with very few exceptions, who really has a good, clear idea of what he's doing, much less how he's doing it. The machine sort of takes over. You know, there's a society, it's moving in this direction, and this is the way it goes, so therefore we go this way. Well, here's the picture that an individual presents. Not a machine running on so many ergs of energy, being driven along rails and in grooves and so forth. But he represents a picture of an individual who is either self-determining to some degree his course in existence, or he is not. And if he is self-determining his course in existence, believe me, he will do it efficiently. And if he's not self-determining his course in existence, believe me, he won't do it efficiently, no matter how many whips are laid upon his back. All the effort in the world cannot overcome the idea of one forthright man. But a very small amount of thought can make a slave over a tremendous quantity of emotion and effort. Thank you very much.